Chapter 9. Purgatory. I found my way to Talum because I was running. I've always been running for as long as I can remember. I ran all the way across an entire world in search of something. Whatever it was I thought I wanted. I guess I don't know what I wanted. I guess I never knew. When I found the passage to the tunnel, it was because she'd called to me. Ying. Irpisha. I heard her. She was right in here. Inside this battered, ugly old head. Can you imagine? She said, climb the mountain. Seek me at the center. And I don't think it's so goddamned unreasonable that I expected her to be there, you know? Someone finds a way to stick their voice right between your ears, and goddess or not, you figure if they went to that kind of trouble, there surely must be a reason. You wouldn't imagine such a fabulous power would be used to have a go at someone. I sure didn't anyway. In fact, I remember what I thought. It was very much something like, oh, well, shit, she said come to the center of the mountain. I'll be there waiting for you. I guess that means she's goddamned there waiting for me. I'd better move my ass double quick and get up there. And she wasn't there. I climbed higher than I ever had until I was so high that not even Erda could hold on to me. And all I found up there was myself and a big damned door. So what do? You see a big damned door like that? And the thing just opens up as if someone's waiting on the other side? You go through, obviously. I went through. Come to think of it, I wonder if that place between the worlds wasn't so much like this cavern you've led me to. How long have we been here now? How's a man supposed to tell time in this place, walking through these fucking caves? I suppose we might have been here 4 hours or 4 days by now. Would you be able to tell me? No, don't answer that. At this point, I don't know that I'd believe you anyway. You don't talk like yourself, Geffen. Have I mentioned that? Your words don't move right, and your face isn't right either. You had this habit of squinting through your eyebrows and pursing your lips when you looked for answers that were hard to find. I don't even think you knew it. It was as common as watching you breathe. Only you don't do it anymore. It doesn't feel like a habit you've broken on purpose. It's just gone now. I wonder why that is. Did you lose yourself when they gave you that body? Did something go wrong when they put you inside of it? I used to think the diamonds they set into our hands were something they did to mark you. They put a mark on you like you belonged to them, and I used to hide mine because I always suspected they'd get me in trouble. At the basest level, which is where I'm most familiar, I figured some back-alley cunt would take a knife to them, try to pry them out and go sell them for a meal or a drink or a bit of gash. Then, at the worst, what if a priest had seen and decided those things in my hands were some kind of challenge? Let me tell you something, my friend. The attention of a priest is the worst kind you can have. Worse than a king's. Priests have a way of making everything last. They can drag things out for as long as they desire, like it's some kind of secret fucking magic. I had some different ideas after I had some time to myself in Talum. About these little studs, I mean. I told you about Hanman, right? Wait, did I or didn't I? Fuck it, never mind. I'm telling you again. I ran into him on the mountainside. And here's the thing, the real thing. When I served him in Theodiscus, and then later when I traveled with him in Walhaz, there were no diamonds in his hands. I was certain there would be, but there weren't. Then I escaped him and found him again later on the mountain waiting for me. And when I found him up there, they were right there in the backs of his hands as if they'd always been. And I think I know what that means now. I think that's how they get you back in your body. I think if you get stuffed into a body without them, you're trapped there. But if you have them, they can pull you right out and stick you back in whenever they choose. It might not even need to be your body, eh? What do you think of that? Nothing? No thoughts? I guess I'm not surprised. Then again, if that's how they stick you in your body, I still don't know how they get you out in the first place. I wasn't born with these goddamn things, and I know you weren't either. Never saw the light glint off the backs of your hands when you were in a scrap, eh? Well, it's not a complete theory. But anyway, I was passing through that damn tunnel, and I don't know how long it took. No real light to speak of, to tell me what time of day it was. Or I guess I should say the light never changed. The whole place filled with it when I got in there. It was much like the light from the raft. Charon's raft, I mean. That pale, even unflickering shit that doesn't offer any warmth or safety. Just this ungodly forever glow that makes the eyes ache and the nose run. And it sure didn't take much energy to get from one end to the other. That's another thing that place had in common with the cavern. The gods remove all weight when you travel along the center line of a world. You fall in every direction, any direction, so long as you can give a little push. So that's what I did. I pushed off and flew like a bird from one world to the next, and I don't know how long I did it for. I never relieved myself, I know that. But then, I'd been fasting a while as well. By the time I'd made it to the mountain foot in Walhaz, I'd grown so hungry that I wasn't feeling the pain of it anymore. I only felt weak. There were dizzy spells when the fucking world wasn't making me dizzy on its own. Then, later, that went away too. I'd been standing there in Erda before a giant door at the center of the mountain. Well, I thought it was pretty big at the time. Then it started to open, and I was sure she'd be on the other side. She wasn't. So I followed the path she'd set for me, and when I came to the next door, I figured she'd be on the other side of that. Again, she wasn't. In her place waited a new world. I remember the warmth first. There was an incredible hiss, like hundreds of snakes all going out of their minds at once, and then the wind hit me full on the face. It was warm, far warmer than I was used to, and right away I could taste the moisture on it. My hands and arms were suddenly damp with it. It was like I was on the Mittlera again. All of Talam stretched out before me. I saw their sun god suspended far off in the sky, anchored to ground in high country. But apart from that, it was nothing like Erda. I never saw so much green in all my life. Not in the forests of Walhaz, not along the grass plains. Looking on that new world, I realized I hadn't even known what green was until that moment. It was absolute. The whole land burned with the color. For some time, I'm not sure how long, I just sat on the mountainside staring. At first, I thought the whole thing was lined in emeralds. I couldn't accept that it was alive. Nothing living had ever made a sight like that. I waited up there a long time. I waited for her. Eventually, I climbed down the mountain. And that was a strange encounter. All the paths were where they were supposed to be. Yet another mirror copy of the last mountain I'd seen, as if that part of the world was the least interesting thing for the gods to build, so they just did the exact same thing over and over. Except in Talam, a name I'd not yet learned by that point, it was all covered in greenery. Enormous leaves, some as big as your chest, with thick purple veins running over broad edges, waxy to the touch and dripping with water. Vibrant flowers, several fruits I wasn't yet hungry enough to test. I could have thought the place a paradise if it hadn't been for the goddamn insects, which were enormous. When I reached the bottom, I waited a while. I'd grown heavy again halfway down, and it was exhausting. I couldn't believe how tired I was. It was as if my limbs had been bound in iron. I think if I'd still been thirsty, I might have just laid down, gone to sleep, and never woken up. But if there was one thing that place had, it was water. All you had to do was grasp a leaf and tilt it down to get a drink. Or if you're high up the mountain, you just pass your hand over the leaf's skin and lick your fingers. but I was still very tired and knew I needed food soon. The forest began just at the foot of the mountain. I considered it. I knew there was a good chance to find food in there, but I also didn't know what might live among the trees. Perhaps there was a good chance for me to become something's food if I went in there, eh? I had no weapons, no way to defend myself. So I thought about that. It's strange. You reconcile yourself with different kinds of death. You tell yourself that certain of them are acceptable while others aren't. I'd been a soldier, marched in an army, right? Took wounds in battle. I knew about those things. So if you stood a man in front of me with a sword or an axe and he wanted to kill me and I couldn't defend myself for some reason, I'd say, oh well, that's a shame. In other words, it would be something I could deal with because I know something about these things. I've done it before. Sure, it would hurt, but then the hurt would not be more than I could bear. Being devoured from the guts upward by some animal, though? I mean, honestly, who in hell's name would willingly stand before that? Half the time the thing won't kill you outright, and it's not even out of malice. It just wouldn't occur to the creature to put you out of your misery. I don't know how to deal with that. To be reduced to food. To be so far beneath consideration that the thing whetting its teeth upon your ribs doesn't see the point in opening your throat first, and then only because there isn't much worth eating in the neck. I stared at the trees. They were strange. Taller than I was used to. Thicker, too. Thicker around the middle, I mean. They seemed to grow ropes of wood all around them, which hung from the branches high overhead and brushed the ground, or twisted up their trunks, or curled from branch to branch like living bridges. And the place was near to screaming with life. The entire forest made a sound, something so constant that you soon forgot you heard it. A never-ending barrage of chirps, clicks, cries, screeches. And then, beneath all that, this long, drawn-out, high-pitched note. It never stopped. Just kept burrowing deeper into your ear like an invisible tick. The sound was on all sides as if the forest itself exhaled through pipes, and kept doing it without cease because it wanted to drive you insane. And then, impossibly, I seemed to get used to it. I didn't even realize I had until the noise stopped, in fact. Sometimes I'd hear something big in there, crashing through the undergrowth, sounds of snapping branches and battered leaves. When it happened, the shriek of the forest dropped away to nothing. The silence that followed usually lasted only a few moments, but during those moments I heard a quiet so deafening it made the hairs on my neck stand up. I obviously went in. The entire edge of the world was covered in the stuff. It was either venture in or starve. Not long after I broke the tree line, I imagine I'd plunged about a mile in, there was a scream as of something dying. For a moment, only the space of a few breaths at most, the sounds of the forest had again died right alongside whatever had issued that scream. The silence that followed, when I was surrounded on all sides by the trees looming over and could barely see more than 20 paces ahead, was the loudest I'd ever heard in my life, so that when the long exhaling hiss of that place returned, I was comforted. Then I found a long branch, which was essentially straight, and sharpened one end against a rock. It took a long time to get it done, much longer than it should have. The strength I used in scoring the tip against the rock leached the energy away so that I could only work at it a few moments at a time. Then I'd have to stand there panting, sweat dripping off my body, mingling with the moisture already there. It was as if the air simply turned to water as soon as it lit upon the skin. When it was done, I tested the point against my thumb and grimaced. The air was too heavy there to make a fine spike. The fibers of the wood were fairly saturated, so that the tip of my sad little spear more resembled a clump of hair all pinched together into a point. I thought about tempering the wood in a fire, then thought a moment later about what it would take to build a fire in that place. I think I've got a few problems, I said to myself. all around the forest cried agreement. I traveled south using what little rays of light managed to break through the canopy as a guide. You could see their direction in there. I saw dust motes swirling in their beams high overhead. I assume most of which was pollen. Birds flew by, hovering between the forest floor and the tree canopy, like fish swimming through the underworld of their natural home. I began to feel like I was underwater along with them. The air was thick enough to assist the illusion anyway. The air around me seemed to shimmer with emerald sparks, as if the green of that place was so powerful that it radiated through the ether in heat shimmers. I walked on. It was not easy going. The ground was wildly uneven and covered all over with growth. The woody ropes hanging from every branch sometimes stretched along the forest floor, and they were so supple they never broke. They'd spill me face forward into the soil if I was careless. Given that I was slowly starving in that dark place, I was often careless. I had to rest often, usually leaned up against a tree. I sat down once or twice, but soon gave it up. It had become too difficult to stand again, and then after I stood, I had to wait a moment, hanging on to the thing I told myself was a spear, but was really just a staff, and wait for the dizziness to pass before I could move on again. You need to get some food in you, I told myself. Water alone isn't going to sustain you, you old digger. Better learn to eat these leaves if nothing else comes along. It's a funny thing about a man alone. He talks to himself. Even being the kind of man who disregards society, the fellowship of his brothers and sisters, when he finds himself alone in the wilderness, he talks to himself. Perhaps it's that he's found in himself the perfect companion, one who will listen and not interrupt, a friend who hears without judgment and understands the very best of your intentions despite your best attempts to hide them. Or, more likely, perhaps it is only that the man is truly alone in the world and cannot stand to be so. Living under the burden of society and having to deal with all the niceties, each gnawing insult each day, a man can be distracted from his own miserable self and wish only his own miserable self for company. He thinks he will be happy when he's finally alone, when he finds a corner of the world unoccupied and fills it. Then, after living with himself for a while, he finds he's filled his corner only with misery and begins to miss the distraction others bring. He begins to talk to himself, wishing for a time when there was someone there to answer. Nuts, maybe, I said to myself. Or berries, I suppose. There must be something here. Any place filled with that much life had food. That is, after all, the nature of life. Something is eaten by some other thing, and on it goes from the largest to the meanest creature. Everything in that forest took nourishment from something else, or at least had the capacity to become food. I had only to find the things that could be made into my food. Simple enough, except that I didn't recognize anything growing in there. Perhaps an hour before sundark, I happened upon a creature I'd never seen before. He was a squat little fellow, no higher than my knee, four-legged, and yet his front paws were nearly the perfect model of human hands, thumbs and all. They were tiny, like those of a baby. The creature used them to pick daintily through the ground cover and to search through the cast-off pieces of fallen trees. I watched him silently from several rootin' away, trying to see his eyes and the nature of his teeth. Did he have fangs? Were his eyes expressive and feeling, or were they cold like a serpent's? But at that distance, I could see little detail. I saw the smallness of his hands and how they flexed and how they lifted small branches from the ground and stripped the leaves into his mouth. The air settled upon everything like a blanket, not moving in the slightest, so I judged it possible to move closer without him nosing me. I took a roundabout path, favoring clear ground over speed. I even lost sight of him a few times and had to search about until I found him again, always on my left. I knew. I just had to keep turning into my left, and even if I'd passed him by, I could keep going, keep turning left, and slowly spiral into him. I think I was at it some number of minutes, edging around trees or climbing over felled trunks or crawling under them, moving carefully through the blanket of greenery floating only a foose above the ground. Moisture everywhere. I was dripping with it. Then I came around a boulder covered entirely in a verdant moss, which seemed furry to the eyes, but transformed instantly into a running slime when I touched it. Beyond the boulder and only a few paces away, I found him. His back was to me, the hair upon it sliding over his spine with each breath. He appeared to be as wet as I was, hunched over so that the blades of his shoulders were his highest part, and the hair there stood in spiked clumps like the tines of a mace. All of his body quivered with life, the kind of life that scurries and digs and scrambles. A fast life, born to struggle, that had to move smartly as soon as his mother licked the birth offal from his body, and had been so moving ever since. The way his head darted, I thought he might live a handful of years, perhaps sire a new generation of young each interval. As a soldier in Dittmar's armory, I'd devoted a portion of my time to the spear. Many of the men in our front line would carry three of them, two to throw as we closed with the enemy, and one with which to thrust when the enemy was upon us. I had not developed the same level of skill as my brothers because I'd not been required to, but I was no dunce either. At 20 paces, I could hit the target more often than not, and the creature I encountered in that forest, which the giants called a chimera, was certainly closer than 20 paces. Unfortunately, I carried only a twisted branch. Even if I'd hit him, I suspect the tip, which might pierce skin if I drove the weapon with a hammer, would have bounced off his flank. But I'll never know. The spear's shaft curved through the air, with the point drawing wide, wild circles as it plummeted well beyond him. For a moment, he froze. I became excited, thinking I'd have the chance for another try if only I could find the appropriate missile. When I crouched to the floor to search out a worthy rock, something seemed wrong, and I think I said, "Oh." Or a sound very much like "Oh." Then everything was dark, and a moment after that I was on my back looking up. I lay there a while. It was very pleasant not to move, and I was already so wet that the clothes upon my back weren't getting any worse being dipped into the muck. The trees overhead were spinning slowly, so I watched them spin. When they stopped, I climbed to my feet. The creature was gone by then, of course. I could see the butt of my spear through the ground cover, some divots where the animal had kicked up the soil, and not much else. I went to retrieve the spear. Then I leaned upon it, closed my eyes, and listened. There was only the creaking hiss, the chorus of life in that place, not even the cracking drag of a small body moving through the bushes. I hung my head and looked at the ground, still leaning heavily on the spear. I think I was looking for the shape of his tracks, maybe hoping to ken the direction he'd taken, but was soon distracted by the creature's leavings. I found a husk in the dirt, something between a nutshell and a seed pod. It was nearly as wide as my palm, brown and textured like oak bark, and had been shredded open along an obvious seam. I prodded into the hole with my index finger and dug toward the bottom of the shell where I couldn't see. It looked like a large brown claw upon my finger when I did. I felt something smooth inside. Cool, velvet texture. Wedging my thumbs within the hole, I pulled the husk apart. Inside, down toward the tip, was the pale flesh of the life it protected. I pried it out, a nugget no larger than the last segment of my smallest finger, put it in my mouth and chewed. It seemed good to eat. Immediately the hunger within me came alive. My stomach growled so violently that it hurt, and I soon found myself on hands and knees digging through the brush looking for more seeds. I found more husks here and there, all of which were ripped open and empty. I was panting. Soon I realized I'd been in that position with my nose in the dirt for a long time, probably, and I couldn't remember exactly how long I'd been that way. I'd stopped looking for seeds at some point, though I wasn't sure when, and had simply been staring into the dirt. I sighed and sat back on my haunches. Then I rechecked the few husks I'd found, but they were still empty. I sat for a while in the muck, thinking about things. I decided that I probably wouldn't find them lying around in the soil. The living creatures of the forest, much like the chap I'd just chased away, were likely to snatch up any such bounty long before I could discover it. I searched higher up and soon found what I was after. Green pods grew from the sides of certain trees in clusters. I battered some of them with my spear, but they were far too strong to knock to the ground. I learned to quickly identify the trees that produced them, though, and soon found pods that were changing in color, from green to yellow to a deep, angry red. The red ones could be knocked to the ground and seemed to darken further even as I examined them in my hands. And the meat of the red pods was certainly not as good as that of the brown ones, but it was good enough. After eating two, I felt some of my strength returning. I did not have to wait for the dizziness to pass as often as before. I walked south.